When everything goes the way you want, career-wise, family-wise, friend-wise, and you are about to retire, but you feel a subtle, barely detectable dissatisfaction, and you're not sure why, what specific things should you do besides ordaining and becoming a monk? Would appreciate no broad stroke, quote, follow the Eightfold Path answers. Follow the Eightfold Path. Is dukkha arising from that? That's funny. That reminds me actually of an incident many years ago. We were helping a little bit to look after a very elderly Cambodian monk, Bante Damawara. And there was kind of he was living at the City of 10,000 Buddhas and being cared for there by various numbers of people, and we go down and visit him. And there was one time when some of his lay followers, not the ones who were really actually doing the actual caregiving, but were kind of kibitzing around what kind of care he should get, and they were kind of arguing over him about whether they should do this or they should do that, or, you know, whether they should take this approach or that approach, and kind of disagreeing. And Bante Damawara was just kind of lying there. He was about 107 at that time, I think. He died at 108 or 9. And anyway, they were going back and forth, and finally one of them turned to him and said, Bante, what do you think? What should we do? And he looked, he kind of opened his eyes and said very slowly, I think that you should follow the Eightfold Path. So it was a broad stroke answer that he gave, but it also kind of cut the arguing down, cut it out. So it's actually not a bad answer. just, you know, the one thing that is notable from this question is that there is this subtle dissatisfaction, even when everything is going our way, career, family, friends, you've got everything you want, you're about to retire. There is this subtle sense of dissatisfaction. There's a famous quote that I always like to mention somewhere along the line that there's only one thing worse than not getting what you want, and it's getting what you want. Because you realize that anything in the conventional world, anything, you know, found in samsara, the rolling on, even if it's the best of all possible conditions that you can find in the world, it can't ever completely fulfill or provide true satisfaction, because eventually it changes, and that urge for those, even those skillful states, you know, having a good career, having good family, having good friends, even those move on, change, adjust, and if we're attached to them, then we experience this sense of dis-ease, being ill at ease, because we've lost something that we've enjoyed in a conventional way. What we're left with is trying to find something to fill the empty space that's left. So the wanting, even on a subtle level, is always there, and the wanting of things to be, you know, different from what they are creates even this very subtle sense of dissatisfaction, because if you take refuge and look for stability in things that are inherently, by nature, unstable and changeable, then you will experience dissatisfaction, suffering, dukkha. So really the only thing to do is to start looking at what it is and how dukkha arises, how dissatisfaction arises, even subtle dissatisfaction when you've got everything that you think that is good in the world. It's actually if it's part of the conditioned realm, it's never going to be good enough. So rather than looking for something else, you start examining what it is that you can let go of, and what it is that you're holding on to, what it is that you're attached to, and you start letting go. And there's a different kind of joy and bliss and peace in letting go rather than trying to get whatever it is, even if it's subtly pleasant mind states or even high meditation states. The true peace is found in letting go. So you just have to start, you know, really orienting yourself to that aspect of the practice and make a commitment to refuge in that starting to, and retirement's a great time to do it, starting to let go and simplify rather than continue to accumulate. Let's see. There's a few questions here that kind of in the same vein. What would be the most difficult thing for you if you were to go back to lay life? And what would be the most enjoyable, fun, nice thing about lay life? That's an easy question to answer because I have no intentions to go back to lay life. So there is no difficult thing for me to go back to if I were to go back to lay life, because I'm not going, I don't have any plans to. And I think my answer to that first question kind of answers that second question of what would be the most enjoyable, fun, nice thing about lay life. Well, you know, I mean, this isn't to diss, you know, having enjoyment in life at all, but I spent the first 40 years of my life having fun and kind of just, you know, kind of got tired of it, at least that kind of fun, you know, and it was sort of like been there, done that. You know, I mean, I had also similarly, you know, good career, good family, good friends, you know, pretty much anything in the material world that I wanted. Enjoyable, you know, times, lots of good activities, you know, bicycling and movies and good food, and you know, oftentimes at the end of the day, I would think, okay, well, what was that all about? You know, wasn't bad, it was enjoyable, but it's gone, and now I have to try and find something else to do that's going to make it all fun and enjoyable and nice. And then somewhere along the line, I met up with this tradition and Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Sumedho and realized, oh, you know, these people aren't out having fun like I am, and they seem to be a whole lot happier than I am. So happiness isn't necessarily related to fun in the traditional sense of it. And so, if for some reason I did end up as a layperson, back as a layperson, you know, through some force or, you know, some sort of authoritarian government coming in and forcibly disrobing me or something like that, I'd probably try and hang out with the other former monks and sit around and talk Dhamma and meditate and go about that just in different clothes. And similarly, if you could give just one advice, or maybe three or four, to someone who lives a lay life with no intentions on becoming a monk, what would it be? Thank you. Well, you know, if you're looking for, you know, something that's a bit deeper and more sustaining in terms of enjoyment and peace and happiness, then as much as is possible, you know, I just really encourage to make whatever your livelihood and whatever your situation is to start turning to make the Dhamma the center of your life. You don't have to be a monastic, a monk or a nun to make the Dhamma the center of your life. You can have a very skillful Dhamma-centered life with the people that you choose to be with, choose to be around the right people who are going to support that, and gradually let go of the relationships that don't support that, and then just keep on, you know, focusing your life in that way. And the most important thing is really just surrounding yourself with people who are like-minded. If you don't have that support of Kalyanamita, spiritual friendship, then it's very, very difficult. Do you notice a difference in monks or the monastery and their practice depending on the country or region they are located in? Like more laid back in California and more something else somewhere else? It kind of depends on the monks and the monastery and the monastics, the monks and the nuns and the monasteries that they're in and practicing in. And you know, there are a lot of similarities, say, in the in our particular Ajahn Chah forest tradition monasteries, whether they're here in the States or back in Thailand or in Europe, England, and all the places around the world where we have monasteries. You can, as a monk, you can almost go to any of these monasteries that are in our tradition and practicing in the same way and feel immediately at home, and that it all feels quite familiar. Of course, there's going to be some differences based on location, culture, you know, the ways that we've, you know, in small ways adapted to our tradition is adapted here to some of the Western cultural values here at Abaya Giri in California, and the ways, the things that we talk about to the supporters and friends around us kind of sometimes have a different flavor than how you would in, say, in Thailand. But I would say that, and then, of course, if you have different traditions altogether that emphasize different things in Buddhist monastic life, then there will be different flavors. But, you know, basically it comes down to everybody suffers and everybody's looking for a way out of it. And so that's the common thread. And with that as a common thread, you know, there's a whole lot more similarities than differences. I was reading somewhere about the Buddha, the awakened bright with splendor, day and night. How do dream states inform our awakening? There's not a whole lot, at least in our tradition, that talks about, you know, using dreams or analyzing dreams to inform our lives during our waking hours. You know, there are some references to causes of different kinds of dreams and what different dream states might mean, but very little really. You know, it's very practical. It's just sort of like, you know, some dreams are caused, you know, are just kind of like rehashing of memories through the day. Some are processing certain kinds of information or feelings or problems. Very few, but occasionally you might find some that are sort of prophetic or, you know, prescient, prediction of what might be happening coming up. And some of them are due to, like, what you ate before you went to bed. So if you eat, you know, spicy pizza just before going to sleep, that's going to affect your dreams too. So it's all pretty practical oriented. Some people do kind of make a practice of writing down dreams, waking up and kind of looking at them to see if they can find out anything that might give them a clue as to what's going on in their world. But it's not something that's really developed to any big extent, at least in our tradition. Okay. How do we protect ourselves from others taking advantage of our kindness and generosity? Ajahn Janako once mentioned that it can happen in the outside world. Some people consider our meekness and humility as weak and try to intimidate or bully us. I just freeze during such times, unable to say anything, thinking it may worsen the situation and be more harmful for me. Yeah, I think that it comes with experience and sometimes some hard knocks, but being kind and generous and having humility, doesn't exclude or preclude also having wisdom and strength and clarity and knowing how to see the effects of what you're doing. And if your kindness and your generosity is causing people to try and take advantage of you, then we just have to be aware of that and realize that that's not encouraging, you know, good qualities in the other person by bowing to that or submitting oneself to it and just letting oneself become, you know, or getting walked over. And that, you know, as best as we can, we're trying not to be, we're trying not to have expectations when we are kind to people or when we give to people. We do it without, to the best of our ability, we do it without having expectations of how people will treat us in return. But it's developing that sense of discernment and realizing that you can still be kind and generous and not have expectations for anything in return. And if somebody tries to take advantage of that, then you have to set your boundary and say, okay, well, I did what I did out of good faith, good intention. I don't really expect anything from this person around it. And they're trying to take advantage of that. Well, I can just, at least for now, you know, withdraw from that situation. I don't have to bow to that. I don't have to support that. I can just, you know, realize that what I tried to do was good, and I'll be the owner of that karma, that good intention. And the best thing I can do at this point so that that person doesn't create any more bad karma of their own by trying to take advantage is to just politely set your boundary, and if you need to, you can walk away. But not with any kind of, very important to guard yourself from getting a hard heart and developing a resentment. That's no good either. There was another one about generosity. Is it fine to give with the understanding of the law of cause and effect, thinking that this generosity will bring benefit to the recipient now, as well as it will benefit us in the future in a similar way? Like Ajahn Janaka once said, when we take care of our elders, we create causes and conditions for us to be taken care of when we become old and need support. Also, like when we provide financial support to others as lay people, we will be financially stable, which is our basic necessity as a lay person. Like when one steals, it can make one a pauper. So yeah, it's good to have an understanding of law of cause and effect, and that good and generous actions will, you know, have good results, both for one and for others. In the same, whether it's, you know, financial or taking care of our elders or whatever way it is that we find to be generous and to share what we have with others, you know, particularly in caring for other people. I think it's also important to remember that the law of karma, cause and effect, isn't all that predictable. So, you know, inevitably there's the question of like, oh, well, this person did so many good things and so many, you know, generous and kind things, and they've always, you know, they've never done a harmful thing to somebody, and yet they're now suffering with some sort of tragedy, or somebody did them wrong, and you know, what did they do to deserve that? They've always been a kind and generous person. Or vice versa, you know, somebody who, you know, is doing horrible things, you know, in the world, and creating lots of difficulty, but doesn't seem to be held accountable for it, gets away with it, you know, sort of like, well, where's the justice there? You know, where's the law of karma there? So it's good to keep in mind that indeed, you know, in general, and very specifically actually, you know, doing good things creates good effects, and doing unwholesome things that cause suffering creates unwholesome effects. But when and how and where that all happens is completely unpredictable. The law of karma, you know, intentional action, operates over, you know, vast periods of time. So in general, we're not sure of when the effects of our good actions or our unskillful actions will result in, you know, will come to fruition. It could be right in this very moment that we experience the benefits of it, what we call instant karma, or it could be later in this lifetime, or it could be in the next lifetime that the effects will manifest. The law of karma is so vast and complex, with so many different factors affecting any one moment, that the Buddha calls it one of the imponderables. Trying to think it through or figure it out on any specific level will just make your head split open. So it's not comprehensible at that level. But just to know that, you know, it still is the law, you know, it's a natural law of karma, this cause and effect. And just, you know, even, I mean, it's not only even, it's one of the most important things of these kind actions, generous actions, things that we would consider to be skillful and would create good results for ourselves and others in the future, is to actually engage with them, do them, and then after it's all said and done at the end of the day, go back and review and think about it, bring it to mind, reflect on it, and in that way you're experiencing the results of it right then and there. Just by looking back at it through the day, and the good feeling that comes up, the settledness in the mind that comes up, particularly if you're going to sit down for a period of quiet meditation or something like that, you know, spend a few minutes recalling all of the good actions by body, speech, or mind that you've done. And you'll bring about very good effects right there in that moment just by reflecting on them. You don't have to wait. How do you deal with anger? Different ways depending on what's going on. But I think, you know, one of the more important things is to try your best not to act on it. Action being either by physical action, like causing harm physically, or action in terms of speech, what we say, how we respond to people. That's kind of the first line defense, is to not act on it in a way that's going to cause harm, because, you know, oftentimes there is this immediate gratification if you're angry, if somebody does something to make you angry, or says something, or you come up with a memory or whatever, you know, we want to dispel that unpleasant feeling. It's a very unpleasant feeling, and the urge is to get rid of that feeling. And so we learn habits about how we think that will best happen, and oftentimes, yeah, we get this kind of quick fix by yelling back or saying something nasty, or, you know, something really clever but very biting or harmful, or even more strongly by striking out in some way. And that does give a very brief moment of release from that energy, but you know what you've done is just sown the seeds for making it even worse. You just transferred that energy of anger outwards, and it's landed in somebody else's lap, and you're just setting yourself up for an endless conflict by acting on it. So oftentimes, if it's due to a specific situation or interaction, particularly if you're in the heat of the moment and it's happening right there and you're feeling it, to use your restraint, kind of hold your tongue, and just to be reflective and quiet and kind of make a resolve to be with that painful feeling inside without trying to expel it onto the other person. And if it's so strong that it's not going to go away and that you think that you might end up saying something or doing something that you would regret, then it's quite legitimate to just quietly withdraw until the emotion settles down and to, if you can muster up the wherewithal to say to the other person, I think right now, rather than responding, I just need to take a time out and let my mind settle down before we talk about this anymore. So I'm going to take off for a bit. Maybe we can come back to this at some later time. So it's quite legitimate and good to kind of remove yourself from the situation if you don't think you're going to be able to deal with it in a skillful way. And then come back, if you can, when the emotions have settled and you can kind of approach it from a bit more settled place to try and come to some sort of resolution. And then just internally, working with the feeling that comes up in the body, once you're on your own and you can attend to your feelings, is to try and, as best you can, to kind of like not reiterate and regurgitate and, go through the whole story over and over and over again in your mind, which is what we often tend to do, thinking that somehow we'll come up with some sort of solution that'll make us feel better. And it almost never works, probably never works. And that the if you can feel and experience the feeling in the body, that's a lot of our practice is body-centered awareness, and all of these emotional states have their reflection in the body. So just to go and attend to that with a lot, trying to bring some kind of care and concern and spaciousness, lots of space to that feeling, and be willing to bear with it. Be willing to say, okay, this really feels bad, this really hurts. Where does it hurt? It hurts right here, or it hurts right here, in the body. And can I just be with that? Can I breathe with that? Can I bear it without spinning off into a story? And then just give yourself a lot of space and kindness to experience that and let the energy kind of just settle down without trying to fix or analyze or justify or create another scenario in your mind about what you should have said or what you, are going to say. Because that just kind of perpetuates the feeling. So working with it on a real tangible level. And then, once if you've attended to it in a skillful way and allowed it to kind of run its course and not acted on it, then your mind will be a lot more clear to actually consider how you want to practically, address this issue. Which kind of dovetails with the next question of how to forgive a person who has hurt and done very wrong things to you. Again, if it's, in the moment and it's recent, just what I was talking about. But also sometimes we have long-term hurts sometimes the people that have hurt us in some way are no longer around, or we no longer are in relationship with them, don't have much association, but the memories are still very strong. And the, you know, the fact that it's been kind of incorporated into the body is very strong too. Body and mind go together. And it is a very skillful and very compassionate thing to do for yourself, to work on forgiveness, because otherwise you're just kind of reinfecting an old wound and never letting it heal. And that's I think it's a good distinction to make about forgiveness versus reconciliation, that, you know, like a full reconciliation with somebody where it's all kind of like worked out and everything is okay again is a very high thing to do and a very desirable thing to do. And oftentimes, unfortunately, it's not very possible to do because you have to have the willingness and the presence of, say, another person to engage in that with in a very conscious, skillful way. But if that's not possible, and oftentimes it isn't, then forgiveness is kind of at least a one-sided kind of reconciliation where you can start working towards letting go of keeping that person in your life internally and kind of discontinuing, say, the karmic connection that binds you to that. Because even, you know, you're bound to people that you have a very negative relationship with in the same way that you're bound to people that you have a very positive relationship with. So if you want to kind of let go of that karmic connection, forgiveness is important. And it really depends a lot on who they were, where they are, what they did, as to how to do that. And if it's very complex, you know, traumatic events, that kind of stuff, then often I think, you know, finding someone who's skilled in helping people through that and engaging in a, you know, a dialogue with somebody who can clearly listen and help you sort things out and help you cope with the unpleasant energies that will come up, you know, as you skillfully attend to these kinds of things in a way that won't be overwhelming, but also kind of starts to open up and let the hurt come out. So some of these things are best done, you know, in conjunction with another person who has those skills to help out with it. And then continuing on your own with allowing the memories to come up, but trying not to proliferate, trying not to create unskillful thoughts around those memories, but gently feeling the feeling and dropping the story and allowing yourself to kind of feel it in that visceral level without necessarily getting so close that you get absorbed into it and get overwhelmed by it. Sometimes you have to kind of give a little space and kind of, you know, approach it very gently from the edges and stop when it's getting to be too much. But again, that's, if you're quite strong in your practice, you know, can take that up on your own in some cases. But if you don't feel quite so confident that you won't be overwhelmed, then best to do with someone who's skilled in helping with that. Okay. I am taken by the idea of volition. Can one enter volition without judgment? Not quite sure the phrasing of the question or the understanding of volition in that question. I don't think of someone as entering volition. But, you know, volition, in the sense that I understand it and that we use it in terms of Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist teachings, also it's kind of synonymous with intention. Volition or intention is sort of when there is any kind of action by body, speech, or mind, if there is intention underlying that or preceding that or informing that kind of action, if there's any kind of intention or volition, then that is what produces kama. That's kamic producing activity, so that there will be a result. Actions that don't have any intention or volition don't have, you know, that kind of mental effect of kamic producing. So, like, I mean, the classic example is if I'm walking down a path and I step on an ant and I didn't know I did it, do I suffer the consequences of killing? No, you're not. You don't suffer the kamic consequences because there was no intention to kill, no volition involved. But if you see that ant and you think, oh, I don't like ants, and you stomp on it, then yes, you will experience the results of that because there was clear recognition and the intention to harm. So that's how volition enters in with karmic producing activity. And certainly, you know, I'm not sure exactly, without judgment, can one enter volition without judgment? One, there can be volitional activities or intentional activities that aren't, like, clearly conscious, so that, you know, we can kind of feel some sort of, you know, there might be a very, like, an underlying tendency, say, towards aversion, and you act on, you know, that there's some aversion in what you do, like in killing the ant or something, but you're not necessarily saying, oh, I hate ants, so I'm going to kill that ant. So you're not clearly thinking, but you're still acting with that unskillful mind state pushing you. And it's that unskillful mind state that's pushing you, then when you act on it, then, yeah, there is intention there. It's just that it's not necessarily conscious, you know, in the immediate moment. So there still is a result of that kind of activity. It won't necessarily be the same as if it's fully conscious volitional activity, but it will still be there at some level, at some extent. So I'm not quite sure if that answers the question. I hope we get somewhere around there. I'm probably not going to be able to get to all of these. How to deal with self-blame associated with losing a loved one due to suicide? My aunt's son, who was clinically depressed, committed suicide. Before he took his life, he saw another death in their neighbor's place, who called my aunt for help. And also, he was getting ready to be sent to rehab center for his addictions. So she keeps thinking if she should not have taken her son or gone to help the neighbor, and also not trying to send him to a rehab center. He would not have taken that action. How to deal with these thoughts and feelings of self-criticism. Suicide is very complicated. There's it seems like today is the day for coming up with old sayings, but this was a saying that I once read in a Stephen Levine book, who worked a lot with people who were dying, and on the chapter that he, in this book on suicide, he said, everybody has a skeleton in their closet. People who commit suicide leave their skeletons in other people's closets. So that, you know, that's kind of a way of saying that, you know, when someone commits suicide, they leave oftentimes a very long-lasting legacy of confusion, remorse, doubt, self-questioning for the people who are left behind, particularly people who are close, because there's always that, what could I have done? Should I have done something different? Why didn't I notice this? Why didn't I see it coming on? You know, did I do something wrong to support it? Did I, you know, like in this situation, you know, should I not have, you know, tried to send this person to a rehab center? Would they still be alive today? So it goes on and on and on, because there's no, you know, there's no space for being able to reconcile that, because they're gone. So it's just very, very difficult one. And again, it's like having to just constantly go back and say, you know, what were my intentions? Were they good? Did I want the best for this person? You know, recognizing that we can't be responsible or control how everybody deals with the difficulties in their life, and that, you know, we didn't wish for them to take their life, and who knows, you know, and just the process of going back and second guessing and rehashing, you know, does that lead to peace of mind? And no, it doesn't. And at some point, we have to realize that just that kind of repetitive rehashing, going back, isn't something that results in relinquishment, letting go, or peace of mind. And we have to, in a sense, retrain our thinking processes to you know, start picking up more skillful things to think about, or ways to think about it. And to constantly reassure ourselves, again, with the support of other people, and sometimes with people who can help you through this process skillfully, professionally, that, you know, we can't carry the load of being responsible for other people's actions when our intentions were, you know, were the best, and maybe there was something that we could possibly imagine that we could have been more skillful. But being skillful is different. You know, we all make mistakes, we all do unskillful things, but that doesn't mean our intentions were bad or wrong. It just means that we haven't had enough experience to be able to see every possible angle and something before it happens. So to forgive ourselves, if there is something that we can find fault with in what we did or didn't do, to realize that we are also imperfect beings, and you know, we make mistakes if we do, and we need to forgive ourselves and move on at some point, because the alternative isn't any good. But just to realize that, you know, it's a very common thing for people who have family members or close ones who commit suicide to, you know, constantly question and to find support from other people who have gone through that. I'll just do one more because it's 4:30. There's quite a few about death and meditation and cremation grounds and dealing with grief and things like that, but I don't think we have time to finish that today anyway, maybe tomorrow. But there's one that says, Ajahn is the knowing, in quotes, awareness, presence, consciousness. Can you say a little more about this? Thank you. Well, it's kind of a more than a little bit, but the word knowing, you know, has different aspects to it. There's a lot of different kinds of knowing or knowledge that the Buddha talks about, and it's all the way from knowing things like facts or concepts that are, you know, kind of on a intellectual basis, understanding things, words and meaning, teachings that we read about and think about and ponder about. That's a kind of knowing, kind of abstract conceptual knowledge. And then there's other different kinds of knowing that the Buddha talks about, more like direct knowing, like directly knowing, say in the Anapanasati Sutta, the in and out breathing. You know, one directly knows I am breathing in, one directly knows I am breathing out. So really taking that direct knowledge to the bodily experience, the oh, okay, not just thinking about it or conceptualizing about it, but actually really directly experiencing some aspect of the body or the mind without evaluation, judgment, proliferation, but just directly knowing it in and of itself. So there's that kind of knowing. There's the knowing that comes with like the knowledge of, you know, the three characteristics and anicca, dukkha, anatta, looking at experience through the lens of Dhamma, the different kind of knowing, and the knowing, you know, the highest form of knowledge is direct experience of the Four Noble Truths, seeing for oneself directly the arising of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and how that comes to be. So these are all different versions of knowing or understanding. And at its base, awareness, presence, are aspects of this. Like awareness often is kind of, I've heard this described as kind of like the fundamental quality, the underlying quality of the mind, of the heart, citta. That's its basic basic characteristic of citta in its pure sense is awareness. Consciousness tends to be in the Buddhist, consciousness is a very tricky word because it means a lot of different things in the English language. In the Buddhist sense, it's the word that's used most often to translate vijnana. And at its roots, looking back at vijnana, vi means like divided. Jnana is knowledge, so it's divided knowing or divided knowledge, and commonly refers to the knowing in relation to any of the particular six sense bases. So the consciousness or the knowing related to visual activity, hearing, taste, touch, smells, and also the intellect, the mind, the thinking mind, the evaluating mind. So it's the consciousness or the awareness that is constantly moving amongst all of those six sense bases. And so it is a form of knowing, but it tends to be more specific to whatever sense bases it's activated at any one moment in time to weave this sense of continuity. So that's generally how more consciousness is used. It is a form of awareness, but it tends to be more specific. So that's just a little bit of a answer on that very broad subject of knowing and awareness. Okay, the rest will have to wait for another time.
Okay, thank you.